from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Joel, I'm Jeremy. It is a Tuesday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. How's it going? Tuesday going okay this morning?
Not bad. Everything's progressing. Not like yesterday or the weekend. I think today is a very average, normal day, which I appreciate. Yeah. Except for the fact that my daughter got up at 12:45 a.m. and decided she was going to hang for a good hour and a half.
Wait, I'm sure you're already asleep.
I was sound asleep. I didn't want Lisa to have to wake up because she has to get up at like 1:45. And I kept, I don't know if you guys have any familiarity with this with relatives or otherwise, but I'm like, okay, normal, there's like a grace period. If you give her like 10, 15 minutes, there's a good chance she'll just shut it back down and go back to sleep. Gave her the grace period and started hearing, dada, dada, no. And I was like, I am screwed. Gave her a bottle, watched SportsCenter, still didn't fall asleep. It gets to the point where the comfort zone for her is if I lay down next to the crib in her room and then I've got to do the army crawl, when she starts fading, if I get her to like, she's asleep, but any noise will get her. There's certain nights that are like this. I got to do like the army crawl to get to the door and then like sneak my way out of the room, and then she'll end up getting back into her sleep zone.
So you're legitimately army crawling?
Oh, no doubt.
Across the room.
Because like my ankles crack and stuff. Like, if I get up and start trying to walk for the door.
Why do your ankles crack?
Because of all the years of playing sports stuff. Yeah.
Just the age?
Like, no, well, I mean, because like if you want to come out and play hoops with us, you'll see how you last.
But I retired from anything active long time ago.
So that's what I'm saying. So the thing is that I'm cognizant of like the hinge on the door. I have to WD-40 it. Because if she even hears that doorknob go when it's ready to seal against the door, she'll wake up.
And she's so a light sleeper, like, huh?
Some nights. Only some nights. But last night was one of those nights, so it was not fun.
Well, I'm glad you're having a better morning today. I'm having a tough time getting this taste of the embarrassment of the Houston Texans and what they've given to this city. Like, the city deserves so much better, don't they? Like, they've lived through some hard times. They've lived, if you want to look just at football, like, the Oilers were lovable. Love you, Blue. But they put the city to some, like, through the ringers, right? Like, we all remember the comeback.
The Steelers game, yeah, the Buffalo game.
Renfro, Montana. I mean, we can go through it. And then Bud Adams just leaving. Like, that's the biggest heartbreak of them all. You get the joy of bringing an NFL team back, and you put up with a bad team for a while because it's an expansion team. And then it didn't help that the Panthers and Jacksonville were good right away, because then it really put the new expansion teams, it made them even more difficult to get good in a hurry because the NFL didn't like that. So it took a while to build it up. And then you get to the playoffs with Kubiak, and you live through the Letterman jackets. You know, you get to the playoffs with O'Brien, and you have to put up with Bill O'Brien as your head coach. And then you're close, right? You have some talent, and then it all goes away at the snap of a finger. Like, the fall from grace has been something that, I mean, you've seen it before in sports, but incredible, the fall of grace that you've had. And we had Ronnie on yesterday, who had the signs in front of Cal McNair's suite. You hear the feedback from the entire city and how, you know, upset they are with the Houston Texans. People aren't ever going to root for the Texans unless Cal sells the team or until he fires Jack Easterby. Like, this city deserves so much better than what the Houston Texans are giving them as their NFL team.
It's so much more and then some. But the thing is that it's like, it's randomly weird that Ronnie has been like the voice that everybody needed. It's like we've had all these random voices coming from every different direction, and all of a sudden, because we were the first to have Ronnie on. Once Ronnie's on, people are like, maybe we should get on board with Ronnie. You know, pick up what Ronnie's putting down. Maybe we should do that too. This is, you know, the hero we all need. Well, the availability for someone to do this has been here for a very long time. I heard Pat discussing something that filling in for Charlie that we've brought up for quite a while, which was, what was the last good move the Texans made? And we went back and said, whether it was getting rid of Bill O'Brien or the drafting of Deshaun Watson, it's been few and far between. The fact that we have to sit there and scrutinize this franchise on a daily basis, and again, it's not just the football team, it's the franchise. I don't know if you guys saw this or not, but the Houston Texans on the Houston Texans verified Twitter account has very much promoted the fact that Justin Reed is up for their man of the year, even though he was the man that they decided to sit down for a week and punish and make an example of, but now he's up for man of the year, so let's promote this guy. They just don't know how to do wrong right. That's the thing that bothers me.
The irony of that was not lost on me, that you have a player that was a healthy scratch and was disciplined for whatever he was disciplined for, and I'm actually team discipline. I have no problem with team discipline. It's just the irony of the guy that you're disciplining is somebody who seems to be very likable, somebody who has, like, it seems like their head in the right spot, their heart in the right spot, and then, oh, yeah, is also the nominee for the team for the Walter Payton Man of the Year. It is pretty funny whenever you kind of break it down like that a little bit. Sage Rosenfels, who does great work with ESPN breaking down the NFL, he comes on the bench every Tuesday, and he had this thought, which I thought was fascinating.
This is the worst offense that I have ever seen in the National Football League. It is void of big plays. It does nothing well, screws up consistently. It screws up the little things. The first play of the game is an interception. The next drive is a fumble. And then it's three and outs and turnover on downs for the rest of the game.
So that was Sage Rosenfels talking about the Houston Texans offense. I'm a DVOA guy. Some people don't know what that means, but the Texans have the worst DVOA offensively in the league. They have the worst pass DVOA in the league. They have the worst rush DVOA in the league. They're dead last in all of them. Some people say, well, throw the stats out. Who cares about the stats? Let's just talk about how many points they're scoring. Okay, let's do that. The Texans are scoring the fewest points than anybody in the NFL since 2012. It's like, it's been a really long time. Like, that's almost a decade in the NFL. The Texans are the worst offense, not this year, not in DVOA, not in points per game. They're the worst offense in a decade in the NFL. Like, should they be the worst offense? When you look at their roster, when you look at what they have, like, should this be historically bad offense that the Houston Texans have?
I don't think it's getting, for as much as media scrutiny nationally and negativity the Texans have taken for everything that they've done and done wrong, this is one that I don't think has gotten enough attention yet. I think that because they're not the absolute rock bottom worst team in the league, at least because of what the Lions haven't done until last week,
record-wise,
and still with the record, which is what everybody kind of uses as the end all be all there. There's no other dive down stats like you're talking about. So I think that it was almost shocking to people that the Texans were the first team eliminated from playoff contention when they thought that they were waiting for the first shoe to drop, which would have been Detroit as well. I don't think there's enough national attention on how bad they've been offensively, probably also because of the fact that Detroit has Jared Goff, which is at least an established quarterback that has gone a long way in a playoff run for the Rams, to which they're like, okay, you know what? We're not going to be that critical of them. And yet they haven't been overly critical of the Texans. And I don't know if it's just kind of like they get a pass for this year because everybody with knowledge of the NFL and experience knows exactly what they're doing, which is tanking and gutting the roster to start over. Or is it, for whatever reason, that's the one area of this team that probably deserves more criticism than they've actually gotten for how rock bottom they've already hit offensively?
And my question, too, is, like, should they be the worst offense in the NFL? Like, Tyrod Taylor was your quarterback for a good chunk of it, and he looked pretty good in the first six quarters, right? Like, he's a serviceable quarterback in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have an argument on where he stacks up if you want to put a rankings of quarterbacks in the world. He's probably top 30-ish, somewhere between 30th to 40th best quarterbacks in the entire world. So he's somewhat serviceable. You have Brandon Cooks, who is a quality receiver in the NFL. You have some talented pieces on the offense. Maybe your best offensive player, Laremy Tunsil, has been out for a while. But, like, from a roster perspective, you look at the offense and then you compare it to some of the other offenses around the NFL, whether it's Detroit, who has the worst record in the NFL, whether it's Jacksonville, who've looked very bad offensively. If you want to go DVOA, the second worst offense in the NFL is Atlanta. The one ahead of them is Carolina. Like, should the Texans, with the talent that they have, and it's a lack of talent, I get it, but their personnel, should they be dead last? Is their offensive personnel better than some of the other offensive personnel
around
the league?
Here's how you'd have to do it. You'd have to do it like we do with a lot of different comparison things and when we do, like, pros and cons. You'd have to line it up and go, okay, Detroit, Houston, starting there because of the records. Better quarterback, which side? I'd say Detroit over anything the Texans have. Better running back, I'd say Detroit better than anything that the Texans have. I'd say receiver-wise, because of Brandon Cooks alone, and because Collins looks like he's got potential, I would probably, and because Galladay, they let walk in Detroit, I'd say Texans over Detroit. Now you look at tight end. I mean, they wasted a big pick in Detroit in Hockenson from Iowa.
Hockenson's solid.
So I would say Detroit probably better than Texans, right? Offensive line, I'd say Detroit better than the Texans.
They shouldn't be, though.
They shouldn't now, be, but
Laramie
they are.
Laramie Tunsil's injury is a big factor into
but
that.
But he's milking it, too. Have you seen the timeline lately of the fact that he's day-to-day? He doesn't know. Let me see. How do I feel? And if this team was a team that was a playoff-caliber team, he'd already be back playing and starting.
I don't think he should play, though, to be honest with you. Whether it's from, like, a Texans perspective, and again, embrace the suck. Try the best you can to get a number one pick. If not number one, at least a top three. Also, like, I mean, either if you want to have him as one of your, you know, if you're protecting the blind side of a quarterback next year, if you're going that route, who cares if he plays the rest of the season? Make sure he's healthy for next year. If you want to trade him in the offseason, don't play him because you want to trade right. him in the offseason. Don't let him get hurt again. So, that can hurt his value. But, like, personnel-wise, I don't think the Texans have the worst personnel in the entire NFL when it looks like from an offensive perspective. I think they have a better offensive personnel than Detroit, and I think they have a better offensive personnel than Jacksonville.
I don't know if they have a better offensive personnel than Detroit just based on what we just did. I mean, they have a better quarterback in Detroit. They have a better running back in Detroit. The offensive line is probably playing better than what the Texans have. Receiver is better for the Texans.
Yeah.
But offensively overall, I think if you just go position group by position group, I would give advantage Detroit. I think as bad as Carolina has been.
Carolina's abysmal.
But if they're healthy with Christian McCaffrey and some of the guys that they have at receiver, that you'd go, I don't think that they're worse than the Texans. I think that the Texans, just by personnel alone, are basically rock bottom. But yet that hasn't gotten as much attention as it probably should. And it started this last weekend when they started showing with the run in the pass where that they ranked. And the fact that, you know, maybe from when David Culley was having to protect Tim Kelly 2 weeks ago, that it started this kind of like spiral effect of, hey, now everybody's starting to dial down and look at it a little bit more. Now they're starting to get into the numbers. Now it really looks like they're putrid and awful instead of just, yeah, not so good.
I believe they have really bad quarterback play, whether it's Tyrod Taylor since he's come back from the hamstring injury has been absolutely terrible. Davis Mills, whenever he took over for Tyrod Taylor, has been absolutely terrible. The offensive line's not playing at a good level. The running back core is awful as well. Your best skill player is Brandon Cooks, but outside of him, you have no one that you can really trust as like a complimentary receiver. And then on top of that, like where I'm kind of standing with the Houston Texans, is that their offensive play caller's awful. Like, yeah. He's really bad. And if you want to go to the soundbite that we played just a moment ago from Sage Rosenfels, that this is the worst offense ever that he's ever seen. And, like, if you want to go points per game, worst offense in about the last 10 years. And to me, it's a combination of both. It's a combination of bad quarterback play. It's a combination of a really bad offensive roster. And it's a combination of having a really bad play caller and offensive coordinator in Tim Kelly. Like, you kind of feel bad for the coaches that they're coaching this roster because it's not very good. But you have bad coaches and a bad roster. So when you have a bad coach and a bad roster, the roster ain't going to help the coach and the coach ain't going to help the roster. Like, at least if you have one that's good, they can help out each other. But when they're both bad, it's going to look like this for the Houston Texans.
Here's where, from your perspective in looking at this, I have to ask you again. I'm a criteria guy. With the criteria being, if you're talking about what their plan is and why not bring Tunsil back? If you're talking about the fact that quietly it's because from an organizational perspective, it's a smart business decision, right? You don't get him hurt. Whether you're going to trade him or keep him, there's no sense in playing him anymore at this point. So it's a business decision,
yeah.
Okay? As opposed to from a football perspective of, for all that fan base still drinking that blue Kool-Aid that's still holding out hope that this team's going to find a way to make a push at the end of the year, even though now they're mathematically they're eliminated from the playoffs.
No one's thinking that, right?
There are fans that still believe on a Sunday they feel better if their Texans win that are thinking if Tunsil's healthy, he should be out there playing, and they don't get the big picture. They don't get the business decision. And I think that the Spurs masterminded this a couple of years ago when they finagled their way into boondoggling and hornswoggling everybody that was sitting
there,
that everybody into believing that, hey, we're still trying to win. But at the end of the day, they were trying to do everything in their power to lose every single game to get Tim Duncan, and it worked.
See, I don't get that. Like, there's people talking to the general manager and stuff saying, let's get some wins down the stretch. Why? What does winning do? Like, is it going to boost morale? Like, is it going to boost morale whenever you go 4-3? Like, I don't get it. I really don't. Like, whenever are you just kissing butt? Is that what you're doing, right? Like, that's got to be what you're doing. Like, if you're talking to the GM and you're encouraging to win some games, certainly you're just kissing butt, right? Like, you don't feel like that's actually a good thing. Like, is winning good? Right now, the Texans are 2-10. Tell me a reason why winning is a good thing. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Also, this offense, do you agree with Sage Rosenfels? Is it the worst offense ever? Is winning good? Is it the worst offense ever? And a couple of new reports on Carlos Correa's suitors. We'll do all of that when we return. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Get low when the whistle goes.
Real fun. Sports. ESPN 97.5. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Days of Giving sponsored by Circle Saw. On the second day, we'd like to give back to Habitat for Humanity. It brings the Houston area together to build homes, communities, and hope. We're encouraging you, our wonderful listeners, to head over to ESPN975.com/12days to give what you can. Plus, David Gao, CEO of Gao Media, has generously agreed to match donations to each charity up to $500. So head to ESPN975.com/12days to make your donation to Habitat for Humanity now. No donation will go unnoticed. The listeners doing a wonderful job on the day one of 12 Days of Giving. We hope that you continue to do that on day two. So I asked a question, like, there's people pleading for the general manager of this team to win a couple of games down the stretch. The Houston Texans are 2-10. They've been eliminated from postseason contention. It seems like, what would you say, 95% of the city is on board with, like, losing down the stretch, try to assure that you get a top three draft pick. Like, what incentive is there at all in winning? And usually I would say, like, it builds morale. It's good to get that momentum going into next season. Like, if you had a young quarterback, I could kind of understand that. Like, get the young quarterback, you know, feeling good, winning some games. Or if you had some young foundational pieces that you're looking to groom, okay, let's learn how to win. That way we can win in the future. But you don't have any of that. You don't have a franchise quarterback. You really don't have any young players of merit that you're really looking at as foundational pieces of your future core. I can't figure out one reason why winning is a good thing. You have to explain it to me. 713-780-ESPN.
Okay, so from whose perspective? From a fan's perspective, it's all selfish.
Anybody's.
It's all selfish and it's all personal. And we've had people respond in the past. It makes my Sunday better when my team wins. Like, they don't get into it. They're not passionate enough about it to follow it on a daily basis, to file the trials and tribulations, follow the trials and tribulations of the franchise, to understand how it's more important to lose right now than to win so that for the big picture, you win more consistently once again. They just feel like, selfishly, I'm going to dedicate 3 hours of my day to watch my team, even as bad as they are. But if they somehow find a way to win, I feel better about myself the rest of the day. Look, I personally feel that when I watch. When with a good team, like, and I went through the years of a bad team, right? But when the Packers win, and like even last year when everybody wanted to give me grief at the end of the year when they lost the NFC Championship, I had to explain to people on Twitter, you don't get it though. Because for like 16 weeks of the winter season, I felt great because of the fact that they won all but three games. They did everything that I didn't expect them to do. And so week to week, I had a great feeling because my football team was winning. So when they didn't win and get to the Super Bowl, sure, it was tough. But at the end of the year, I had way more positive weekends than negative weekends because that's how much I cared about my team. So I get it from a certain degree. But to answer your question, I think a lot of it, people from a selfish perspective, their takeaway is, if the Texans win, I feel good. If the Texans lose again and they know that sludge is coming for the next 2 or 3 days, because no matter which way they turn and whether they're on the internet or listening to us or watching TV, it's going to be the laughingstock of the NFL does it again, and that hurts to a lot of people.
Yeah, maybe the casuals, right? Like, I feel like you have the diehards of the city that even if they're still in with the Houston Texans, that they want the Texans to embrace the suck. They want to get as high a draft pick as you can. They want to start looking ahead to the future. And the best way to look ahead to the future is to get as high a pick as you possibly can and then stockpile some draft picks and try to find some real foundational pieces for this team going forward. And you also have a small percentage of people that just have quit on the Texans, whether it's Cal, whether it's Jack Easterby. And then maybe you do have the casuals, the 22,000 that are still showing up to NRG, yeah, that are just happy to go to their first ever NFL game, and they're going to cheer for the team with Houston across their chest, and they really don't care, right? Like, whenever they leave the stadium that day, if you win, great. If you lose, who really cares?
like from the Ronnie perspective, and he started to answer it. I didn't want to jump on him because I appreciated him coming on yesterday. And look, and I love the cojones he had to be able to go up to Cal's suite with that sign. It's one thing to say fire Easterby in the stands. It's another thing to go right up in front of Cal's suite and do what he did. And so I give him all the credit. Well, that's why I didn't want to press him too much on this. But it's like a catch-22, right? If you want to be that guy that's coming to the game with that sign that you want to make sure Cal sees, the flip side of that is you're still supporting this team by throwing money in Cal's pockets, by being a season ticket holder, by coming to every game. Though granted, this time now you're trying to deliver a message for the fan base that's upset, you're still helping him in the process to where he could chuckle and go, you can carry your sign all you want, but I'm carrying your ticket money into my pockets and still profiting. So it's tough because you say that there's 25,000 people that are still going to games, and you wonder, like, if they're frustrated too, then why do you still go to the games? Why are you still spending your money on this team?
See, I think the other angle you can look at it too is, like, do you want to be labeled as just a T-shirt fan? Or, like, do you want to be a diehard of the team where you're, even in the bad times, you're still one of the few that's in the stadium? Maybe you're holding up a sign. Maybe you're putting a paper bag over your face. But I can see that point of view. Like, if you're going to ride or die for a team, that you're going to ride with them even whenever they're awful and they're a laughingstock and they're an embarrassment of the NFL.
I think thanks to social media, you can make your statement, though. You can say, okay, this is it for me. I'm done. Until they do this or this or that, I've given them my money. I've supported them with tickets and merchandise. I can't do it anymore. Now, then you just set your parameters. But if they do this or they start doing that or they get rid of him, then I think I can come back. But in the meantime, I just can't anymore. And it also drives me nuts that I'm still perpetrating the fraud by giving them my money for a subpar product that frustrates the hell out of me.
Yeah, a little personal boycott. That's a good question. If you're one of the 22,714 that go to NRG every Sunday, why? Why do you do it? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Did you see the new suitors for Carlos Correa? Which, by the way, thought we were in a lockout. I guess the lockout isn't stopping teams from talking to the representatives of each of these Major League Baseball players. But John Heyman thinks it's between the Astros and the Dodgers when it comes to the Carlos Correa sweepstakes. Meanwhile, Bob Nightingale telling Patrick Creighton that the Astros are out of the sweepstakes. So it sounds to me like no one really has any idea what Carlos Correa is going to do.
Well, the thing that's going to be interesting in this discussion on this show would be that the alternative for the Astros that Bob Nightingale talked about is one player and one player only that I know you put on a pedestal like no other that you think is just so valuable it hurts. And because when you break down his numbers, you say that guy should be an Astro. And that's Trevor Story. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're an Astros fan or if you're Jeremy Branham, you hope like hell they're going to make one last final push to get Carlos Correa back, because the alternative just could be doomsday for this franchise when you start thinking about it. Because you start, I mean, look, I heard the bench this morning, and it was a really good discussion about what we've talked about in the past. No 10-year deal makes sense. No 10-year deal pans out. It was the Washington Post, I believe, did a see-if-you-can-guess-who-I-am kind of thing. But they had given the stats previously and then showed the massive drop-off. It was Christian Yelich.
I thought that was Larry the GM, the Astros.
Granato had said, I think Granato, when I was listening, had given credit to the Washington. But anyway, they were going back and forth on it. And my whole thing was, yeah, in my own backyard from where I'm from, Christian Yelich was the savior that mid-market team needed. A guy that could have gone to the Dodgers, that could have gone where everybody was throwing cash at him. But he chose to stay where a team wanted him. And it was like a win-win. And now it's like a big loss, because when you look at it, he's fallen off the planet and isn't productive. I get it, because you got to get your bag when the time is right, right? Some guys only get one opportunity. Some guys don't get it when they're in the prime of their career. I don't fault Correa for making this thing last and getting all the competition involved and how many different offers you can get. But at the end of the day, I don't fault the Astros if they fall short, because they're refusing to go to the extent of a lot of other teams and commit business suicide later in the contract by saying for the last 3, 4, 5 years of this deal, he might not come close to being anywhere near of return on investment value for what they're putting in.
10-year players that have signed a contract for 10 years or more in Major League Baseball history. Mike Trout, too early to call, maybe?
Too early to call. He's still, by most accounts, he's still the best player in baseball.
Bryce Harper, probably too early to call. Just won the MVP, too.
MVP, so you can't criticize.
Giancarlo Stanton.
complete and utter disaster. If you're not the Yankees with a cash cow where you can afford to keep paying him that money, Miami was doing anything. That was the equivalent of John Wall in baseball. Like, that guy's killing us so badly that no one will touch him. The fact the Yankees did was like a celebration day in Miami.
Manny Machado?
Too early to call. He's a good player, not a great player. We'll see if he can continue to, at least from a defensive perspective and overall, be above average.
Alex Rodriguez twice.
He turned out, look.
Well, the Rangers traded him in year 3 of 10.
Yeah.
And then the Yankees flat out released him before his contract was up and just bought him out. Albert Pujols with the Angels.
A disaster.
Robinson Cano, Seattle.
Disaster.
10-year contracts do not work.
Cano's drug suspensions have actually done a favor for the teams, because the Mariners and the Mets, because of the fact that by doing that, at least they recouped some of the money that he wasn't doing on the field. Because, look, all-around good guy, headed for the Hall of Fame type guy from the Yankees when he was with the Yankees, has just completely crapped all over his own career. Yeah. It's awful.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Last night on Monday Night Football, classic weather game, classic Belichick game. And the Bills and Sean McDermott a little bit salty afterwards. That's next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Stay up to date with the latest innovations hitting the city of Houston by visiting InnovationMap.com or follow them on any of your social media platforms. Just search Innovation Map. Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Here's Allen, straight drop. Allen throwing, and it's knocked away. Miles Bryant able to knock the pass away, incomplete. McCourty came on the blitz, brought the pressure. They turn it over on downs, and Buffalo can only stop the clock one time.
Patriots over the Bills in Monday Night Football last night, 14-10 in a weather game. We'll get to that in 5 minutes. But first, let's go out to the HR&P listener line. Mario, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
Hey, Killer Bees. Thanks for the show. Thanks for letting me on. Wanted to bring up the difference with the Correa contract versus the other 10-year contracts you guys mentioned, is that the age of Correa is a factor, so I'm real curious as to what age the other 10-year contract that you brought up earlier, at what age did they start to go bad, and how does that compare to Correa? And also, none of the guys that you mentioned are locker room type leaders like Correa, and once we lose Correa, when and if that happens, I don't know who's going to take lead in this locker room. And I worry that we're going to end up with a whole bunch of talent, but no true leader in that locker room to put everybody on the same page.
Mario, we appreciate the call. Look, I think there's still guys in the locker. Quietly, Michael Brantley, he just doesn't draw attention to us. And Altuve are leaders. Bregman is the outspoken visual representative that would be next in line to take over that leadership role. And I think a lot of the reasons why we constantly were wondering where the old Alex Bregman was when he did those kind of things was he just wasn't healthy. If he's healthy, he could do it. To the comment about, like, guys on that list that aren't leaders, Pujols was a leader for the Cardinals forever and a day, on and off the field, when he was in his heyday. You just can't be a leader when you fall off the planet ability-wise and aren't living up to the contract you signed.
Yeah, there was really two topics that he brought up. One was like the age of the other dudes that have gotten big contracts. I think it's comparable to where Carlos Correa is at. Like, Alex Rodriguez was younger than Carlos Correa when he signed the first one. Miguel Cabrera was probably somewhere around the same age. Pujols was a little bit older. Cano, I'm guessing, was probably around the same age as well.
Maybe a little older.
Stan, I think, was younger because they signed him early.
Maldonado as well as Yelich were both, I think, same age or younger when they signed their deal.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was about the same. In fact, I think you have to be around that same age to get the 10-year deal. Like, if you're a free agent when you're 32 years
Machado.
Old. Machado. Yeah,
Machado,
not Maldonado.
Not Maldonado.
Yeah, Maldonado was never confused for getting a 10-year deal for $300 million.
Machado and Yelich.
But also, like, whenever a player enters free agency or when a player signs a 10-year or longer deal, how old are those players usually? Like, you're not going to give that out to a 31-year-old free agent. You're not going to give that out to George Springer.
Springer's the one that always comes to mind. Like, we love George Springer. We loved everything he did. If the players negotiated the right deal, Springer might have been up at a time when you would have seen him get a 10-year deal. By the time he became completely free of everything to be a free agent, he was basically looked at by teams as a short-term fix for 3 to 5, but there's no way that they were going to give him 10 because of his age.
Here's my thought, too, with the leadership with Carlos Correa. This is not going to be a popular opinion, and I love Carlos Correa. I mean, you know this, that I love Carlos Correa. I feel like a little bit of what Correa does is a little bit of false hustle, too, right? Like, is the leader the dude that's going to the mound and be like, hey, man, let's get this guy out? Is the leader the one that's yelling outside of the clubhouse during the scandal to shut you-know-what up to Cody Bellinger? Or is it Jose Altuve, who's kind of the quiet leader, and whenever he speaks, everybody listens? Justin Verlander was very vocal and very much a leader back in 2017. Look, I think Correa brings a lot to whatever team that he's on, and it's been the Astros for every year of his career. He brings excellent defense. He brings a pretty good stick. He brings a well-above-average stick for the shortstop position. But let's not lose sight that Carlos Correa is coming off a peak year, the best year he's ever had. He's always had injury concerns. He's never quite lived up with the bat to the billing. And also, like, the leadership stuff to me, too, is, like, it's a little bit overrated. Like, what is – we don't know the leadership. We don't see the clubhouse stuff, too.
Also bothers me.
But the leadership first. Like, in the clubhouse, like, we don't know what's going on there, right?
But here's the other thing. There's a difference between leadership and being an igniter. Like, I think Springer was more of an igniter, like, the heartbeat and personality of the team, like, when they were too high – He
was like the emotion, you know?
Yeah, that's what I would say. There's an igniter because he was the leadoff hitter, too, and he did a lot of things on the field. But in the clubhouse and whatever, if an umpire made a bad call, he'd pick his spots. But when he went hard, he went hard, and the team loved it. When someone needed to dance in the dugout after a big play, or someone needed to pump the fist and really give it to you after a defensive play, or someone needed to nudge A.J. Hinch and go, lighten up, coach, we're good. Don't call him coach, by the way, manager. But those are the kind of things he did, as opposed to, like, when you mentioned Altuve, the one that I always go back to is, everybody always said, was Altuve really a leader? And then you go back to the one time where Lance McCullers Jr. showed up Yuli at first base because Yuli didn't field the ball cleanly. And after the inning, Altuve grabbed him and said, come with me. They went to the very end corner of the dugout, but he lit him up and was like, that's not something we do here. That's leadership. That doesn't have to be seen by the media or talked about at a press conference or known by anybody else, but that's leadership internally that you have to have.
A lot of times we confuse being loud for leadership. And Carlos Correa, and again, I love Carlos Correa, so this isn't me bashing on Correa, but a lot of times loudness can be confused with that leadership, and Correa has been loud. I mean, very vocal, again, with the Cody Bellinger stuff. Very vocal with Framber Valdez in the ALCS 2 years ago when he goes to the mound and he starts tapping him on the chest after Framber got yelled at by the Tampa Bay Ray. But whenever that voice is talking in the locker room, what's the one that gets the most attention? Is it Jose Altuve or is it Carlos Correa? Because in my mind, it's the guy that never speaks, but when he speaks, listen.
Completely agree. It's like if Yuli finally decided to say something. You know that there's a guy that just quietly goes about his business, and you can't fault what he's done. Gold glove and a batting title. But if Yuli decided to speak up and say something, then everybody in that clubhouse would be like, whoa. But the guy that's doing it every day, and let's be honest, a lot of that this year was for his own benefit. Correa time, and by the way, after Correa time, the clock struck midnight for the rest of the playoffs until he got some really meaningless hits that got his average up a little bit. But all it was that one home run. Altuve was the guy that consistently kept hitting those. He had a big home run in that game, but he also did it periodically yet still throughout the playoffs, and he had his numbers, and he had his key hits, and he did the things you needed to do. Correa, what he was doing most of the year was betting on himself, and part of betting on yourself was marketing yourself. Correa time was like something that comes to the table in the negotiations going, look what I can bring to your franchise. Look what the extra that I got that means something. And he'll get paid for that. I just don't think the Astros are in the market to overpay for that.
Yeah, I mean, you can get over, you know, what you lose in productivity. And if I'm like, I get a little tired of like, oh, when Correa's gone, the leadership's going to be gone. Because I don't believe that. Because Altuve is the leader in that locker room. He's the leader in that clubhouse. We had a text in 713-780-3776. The same McCullers, you know, is a leader. Maybe he is a leader for the pitching staff. I believe Verlander could be a leader for the pitching staff.
But the
Astros won't be without leadership is the point. Like, they can overcome whatever leadership that Correa had, and a lot of times noise can get confused a little bit for the leadership.
Similar in the comparisons. From a Rockets perspective, they don't have – I talked about this weeks ago. They don't have the right veteran mix to provide leadership and guidance right now because Eric Gordon wants out. John Wall wants out. We don't know what Christian Wood wants on a daily basis. The right veteran mix are the leader of the pitching staff's now going to be – they didn't have one last year. They were searching for a guy they could lean on. They didn't have that kind of experienced guy that could also lead them down the path. McCullers was starting to try and do some of those things, then he got hurt. But Verlander's the guy that unequivocally is the leader of the pitching staff. Altuve's the leader in the locker room quietly, especially from the fact that he leads by example. Brantley right there with him. Uncle Mike doesn't speak much, but if Uncle Mike speaks, people listen. So they have leadership. That's why I said, are you looking for a cheerleader? Are you looking for a locker room leader? Or are you looking for an igniter? Because there's three different things here.
Yeah, and again, this isn't a bash for Correa. It's just that the Astros aren't going to be lost without Correa's leadership in the production that he gave you. Very good. I mean, Brian McTaggart, MLB.com, Astros.com. They're searching for things to talk about because the baseball's in a lockout right now. He had the best single season of any shortstop in Houston Astro history. So it's not a knock on Carlos Correa. It's a conversation if you're willing to spend $325
million.
Adam Everett
would like to have a word.
Yeah, right. I loved Adam Everett. I loved the glove of Adam Everett. Just couldn't hit a lick.
But look at who you're being compared to when you say that stat by itself. Yeah. When you just say that, you're like, whoa. Then you think about all the shortstops in Astros history and the traditional shortstops, a light hitting, smooth gloved shortstop like Adam Everett, Julio Lugo, Craig Reynolds. I'm going through history going, they just didn't have the kind
Miguel
of shortstop.
Miguel Tejada was an Astro for a
third
year
base.
Or two. I think he played some short.
Primarily third base.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
I mean, we're arguing about Miguel Tejada when he was 38 years old.
If you had
Miguel Tejada
that was great with the A's, we would have a different conversation.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. You mean post-steroids, Miguel Tejada? I didn't say that. Allegedly.
Something happened in my headset. I didn't hear you.
Let's go out to the HRP listener line. Cruz, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
Yes, about Correa.
Yep.
I think you need that leadership, you know. And not only that, just remember the defense win championships, and he has a lot of that, a lot of defense, you know, with the home runs and all that, you know.
Cruz, you're not going to spend $325 million on a defender,
Cruz,
though.
You're going to give those intangibles 10 years at 30 plus million a year. That's going to make that big of a difference.
Yeah, he also takes up for the team a lot, you know, for the teammates and everything off the field.
He did that.
So does Dusty.
Appreciate the call, Cruz. Thanks for listening to the Killer Bees. I mean, look, that is part of the fanfare for Carlos Correa. People love Carlos Correa because
put a value on it,
he was loud.
A dollar figure. What's that worth to you?
Are you talking about just the leadership?
I'm just talking about the intangible things he was bringing up.
See, I mean, it's a loaded question because, like, what are we talking about in, like, his overall productivity on the field? You know what I'm saying?
And I'm not trying to put you in a corner.
I know.
What I'm trying to do is to kind of put perspective on the call, put a value on it, and then tell me that those same intangibles are going to have the same value in years 5 through 10.
I mean, I wouldn't pay more than like 20, 25 million.
See, and you're talking about the overall. I'm talking
per
about
year.
Just the intangible
part. Yeah, I'm talking about
it,
with the bat.
Not the glove and the bat and all the other things. That's the leadership. And the, you know, the sticking up for his teammates kind of things. At the end of the day, that's not going to make you want to pay the extra $10 million a year.
Yep.
For the last 5 years of the deal.
You can find a glove for cheap. Like,
yes.
You really can. I mean, there's free agents out there that Andrelton Simmons is one.
I was going to say,
one.
We joke about
like
Andrelton
Simmons,
but if it was just defense alone, there's a guy you'd consider.
And Jeremy Pena, to me, is going to be a very good defensive shortstop. Maybe not to the level of Carlos Correa, but he's not going to be a huge drop-off defensively. No, the drop-off that you're fearful of is what he does with a bat. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Let's talk about this Monday Night Football game from yesterday. How big a statement was it for the Patriots? That's next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
This is Heisman Trophy winner, College Hall of Fame, Billy Sims, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5.
Hey, right now I want to tell you about New Breaks, guys. Look, I've had listener after listener get back to me and say, great call on New Breaks. It was so painless. It was so easy. The job was done right. It was fantastic. I'm going to tell all my friends. You can be the next in line to use New Breaks. It's nubreaks.com. And I'm telling you, it takes all of the worry and the pain out of getting your brakes fixed. They're skilled technicians. All they do is brakes. They come to you to do what they do. It's like doing your groceries instead of blowing an hour at the store, doing it curbside or having them deliver to you. That's what New Breaks does. They come to you to your job while you're still working or in meetings like me doing a radio show. They come to the parking garage, fix my brakes in less than 40 minutes. It's painless. They use the same products and same parts as any brake shop in town, and their prices are comparable, yet they save you so much time, which is money. Check them out today, NUBrakes.com, NewBrakes.com. Mention ESPN 97.5. Save 10%, but save time, which is saving you money, and get your brakes done right the first time. It's NewBrakes.com.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ocho saying on Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN97.5, I don't need a leader. I'm a grown man. Lead yourselves. Which is true. I mean, how much do you think Jose Altuve is getting the benefit of Carlos Correa's leadership? You think Michael Brantley is hitting for a higher average because Correa's saying, here we go, Mike. Here we go, Uncle Mike. You got this. You can do it.
And 832-425 on text, because the first one wasn't enough, had to send two separate texts to show how much he believes Lance McCullers is a leader, because he was in the dugout being a cheerleader the whole playoffs. Look, you get the participation trophy because you stayed with your team after you got hurt. And we just said cheerleader is different than dugout clubhouse leader. And McCullers, not to take knock Lance either, because he wants to be that, I think, in a lot of ways, too. It just hasn't gotten to that level for him yet or for the team yet because of the other guys on the roster.
I think Lance probably thinks he's more of a leader than other people think Lance is a leader. And I believe Lance carries, you know, a stick around there. I believe he does carry some weight, and he's a veteran. Sure. But, I mean, how far does that go in Major League Baseball? Probably not all that far. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Let's go back out to the HRMP listener line. John, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
Hey, man, I just want to thank you, man. My God, talking about Correa with this knock time and one home run, everything you said was exactly what I saw. I thought Correa, man, was going to explode in the playoffs and in the World Series and earn this big contract he wants. And don't get me wrong, I love Bats, though. Hell, I just bought a big chrome-plated helmet from Bats for $200. You know, because I love the Astros so much. But it is what it is. Listen, if anything, if they were going to get that kind of money, they could have probably tried to sign Simeon or something like that. But let me leave you with this one thing, man. I'm embarrassed to say it. I hate to say it. But listen, man, the last four seasons, the Astros have melted down on offense in the playoffs. They beginning to look like the Bagwell and the Biggio team when they get to the playoffs. They can't hit, man. They lost to Tampa Bay and Atlanta, man. But hey, thank you, man, for what you said. And that is the truth. Y'all have a good day.
Thanks for listening, John. They had a couple of breakdowns pitching. That's kind of why the breakdown happened this last year. But their offense could have been better.
Their offense was pretty bad in the World Series. In the playoffs, leading up to the World Series, it was just fine. But they got shut down by the Braves pitching
staff.
Because
when one guy was down and someone else picked him up, too, right? They had so much talent in the lineup that when other guys were scuffling, there were still enough guys that were hitting that got them through, like Yordan, right? Yep. Until Yordan scuffled and everybody scuffled in the World Series.
Yeah. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. A weather game last night in the NFL. The Patriots with their 7th win in a row as they beat up on the Bills 14-10. Patriots' best team in the AFC. And Bill Belichick, as usual, just can't quite control his excitement.
Yeah, we got a big one against Indianapolis, and they are obviously a good football team. So turn our sights to them, and not really worried about what happened in the past. Just get ready for Indianapolis, and they're tough, you know. That'd be a tough matchup for us. So, a big challenge out there.
Look at Belichick, man. He's just pumped up. You go into Buffalo, you get the victory against a tough Bills opponent, and Bill Belichick just throwing a party for himself after the game.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if we did our show every day like that? Like, you know, something happened with the Texans and went, it's one of those things. You know, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. Nick's doing his best job. David's here to head coach. And the players are just going to, they're going to play. And we'll work it out from week to week. Now it's on to the Seahawks. They're a good team. Russell Wilson's a good quarterback. I mean, there's no emotion out of the man. I get it. His resume speaks for itself. But, like, other than that, when he speaks for himself, God, it's painful. It's like nails on a chalkboard in a lot of ways, because you're like, dude, you just won the game that everybody said could be the make or break for the Patriots. As good as they've been, they got two coming up with the Bills at the end of the season that are going to be vitally important. Everybody's log jammed. If you lose this, this could be a downward spiral in a hurry. You won a massive game, and there's not a single ounce of emotion.
Yeah. Not, it's kind of his shtick, right? It's what he does. Meanwhile, you got some emotion on the other side
sure
of it.
Did.
The Patriots win this game with Mac Jones throwing it only three times. Josh Allen threw it 30 times. Did you notice, by the way, that Bill Belichick wore a Navy mask to the game? What does Navy do with their offense? They run a ball a lot. Was it a little innuendo?
Yeah, maybe.
Was it a little bit of hinting from Bill Belichick? Patriots 6-0 on the road now. But Sean McDermott was not pleased after the game. And all the Belichick praise, he wasn't here for it.
Let's not give more credit than we need to give credit to Bill Belichick in this one. It was, whether it's Bill or anybody else, they beat us, right? But you sit here and you tell me when we start with the average starting field position of the 40-yard line and he starts with the 23-yard line, and I'm rounding up in both cases, and we were 1-for-4 in the red zone and they were 0-for-1 in the red zone, you give me that ahead of time, I'm saying I like my chances. I like my chances. So it's not, I don't think, with all due respect, it's not a Bill Belichick type thing. It's what are you doing with the opportunities you got? What are you doing with the opportunities you got? We turned the ball over at the plus 30-some yard line. Sloppy football. Sloppy football. So I'm very comfortable in that situation.
Don't you take the coaching a little bit of the reasoning too, though? Like, I mean, he's the one who's scheming up the plays that led to the turnovers. He's the reason that the offense isn't turning it over. Like, you know, this game could have went either way. Buffalo makes a field goal that they missed, and then you get the field goal on the last drive. Buffalo wins, and we're singing a lot different tune today. But you credit the other coach. You credit the other coach when they win. I feel like Sean McDermott, not a good look. I'm a Sean McDermott guy.
I
would
too.
Say
I
he
like
was a
him.
Great coach before anybody really thought he was a great coach. But this was not a good look for Sean McDermott.
Well, here's the thing on Sean McDermott, too. It's adjustments on the fly. They said that from a New England perspective, they threw the entire game plan out the window when they knew the wind was going to be like that, and they adjusted on the fly, and it worked to a T. Because early in the game, when you think about it, the shanked punts, when the wind was going against the Patriots in the first quarter, I thought, oh, my God, they're going to gift the Bills the game. Their first two possessions started at midfield or at the Patriot 40 or 45, and you get nothing out of that. They did what you were supposed to be able to do too, which is just get some holes, get some yards, run the football, maybe get a little bit on edge, off tackle, do some things that kind of open it up a little bit more. But if you did what they did but did it as good, you'd be in the ball game.
There was a lot of people that were mad. Go ahead, Brendan.
I don't know if I was off base here, but I kind of took that at least a little bit as we weren't good enough. He didn't beat us. Not so much like, let's not give credit to Belichick. The players did this. I kind of took that as him saying we were not good enough.
I agree with that, but don't say Bill Belichick's name. Like, you talk about us. Like, okay, well, we weren't good enough to win today. Don't sit there and say, oh, let's not give the praise to Bill Belichick. Let's not give him the all of the love, and then talk about where they were poor. Like, just talk about where you're poor. Don't put Bill Belichick's mouth in your or name in your mouth.
Not the perfect delivery. I just don't think the message itself was that bad.
See, I got the sense listening to all the postgame that this was the Bills. They don't like the Patriots. The Patriots are the team that's always better than they are. They really want to beat the Patriots bad. Here's another one with Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde after the game. A couple of defensive players for the Bills, they got a little bit salty after the game as well.
40 years since a team has won a game running that few times in a game. I mean, passing that few times. Is that embarrassing?
I mean, what kind of
boy, what are we doing,
that?
Bro?
What kind of question is that? I think we gave up 7 points.
Yeah,
14 to 10,
is that the final score?
We made stops when we had to. They had one big run. I mean, they got good backs. They kept coming back to a couple of runs. I mean, I don't know how you want us to answer that question.
That's funny. Well, we'll remember that. I'll remember that.
What are you going to remember it for? Like, how are you going to use that?
He went on further to point at the guy and everything else, Micah Hyde did, as if to say, like, when, you know, if there's ever a time when they're on the field or, you know, asking questions. Players hold grudges. They will either blow them off or, you know, we've seen Verlander as a perfect example. Like, when you remember something that's been written or said by said member of media, some people, it sticks with them a long time and they want paybacks and they're going to treat you differently because of it. It was a little bit over the top because I give them credit for giving New England credit, saying they got good backs, okay? And I understand, look, they weren't embarrassed. It was the elements playing. playing a major role in a game that I think that if we were on in regular weather conditions, that the outcome might have been different. And obviously a lot more passes would have been thrown, especially by the Patriots. But at the same time, you have to deal with what's given to you. The circumstances are sitting there. The elements are part of it. It's how you adjust. You guys weren't able to adjust the way the Patriots were. You weren't able to be as effective as the Patriots were. Tip your cap. Give them credit. You'll see them in a couple of weeks. Maybe things will be different. But for this week, this night, it wasn't about what you didn't do. It was what they did.
I'm really shocked they didn't use Josh Allen more in the running game. The fact that he threw it 30 times. Like, this was a perfect game where you saw all the Patriots. They ran it every time except for three offensive plays. Josh Allen threw it 30 times. Like, why not get a little bit, like, I'm not saying play option football. Why not some zone reads? Why not give Josh Allen the option to pull the ball out of the belly of the running back? Keep it yourself. Like, he was, to me, Josh Allen's the perfect quarterback for that game.
Even when he pulled it down and ran, it seemed like a lot of times he eased up and just kind of cut the play short when there were still more yards to be had that could have made a difference for the team. And look, let's be honest. If you watch that football game, the laser that he threw for the touchdown was unbelievable, the defenders that he threw it through to get it where it needed to go. There was the deep ball to Diggs in the corner that, yes, Diggs had to adjust over one shoulder to the other shoulder. The ball hit him in the forearm. When a receiver can look and see it and it hits him in the forearm, it wasn't a poorly thrown football in those wind conditions, but I'm totally with you. You can't throw it. You have to adjust. You know that the wind and the elements are playing that big of a factor. You can't sit there and say, my game plan is still to throw it 30 times.
Yeah. 30 times when you have a quarterback that can run was kind of curious. It is a regular season game, though, and the goal is to have Josh Allen healthy in the postseason. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. When we come back, the fifth day of Texans Christmas, what are you hoping Santa brings to this Houston Texans franchise? That's next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
My name is Bob Lee, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5.